I'll introduce the panel. Most of them need no introduction to any of you. Dr. Mark Coppinger, who is Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and Philosophy here at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and engages with pop culture quite often in commentaries and columns and articles. Dr. R. Albert Moeller, Jr., President of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, who also engages with pop culture repeatedly, including just this morning in his blog up at www.albertmoeller.com on the issue of pop music and marriage, and we'll talk about that issue in a few moments. And then Ken Myers, who is the author of All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes, great title, Ken, and who is the host and producer of Mars Hill Audio, that deals with issues of Christianity and culture, Christianity and politics, Christianity and any number of issues. And we are very grateful to have Ken Myers with us this week doing Gein's Lectures and Institute for Christian Worship Lectures here at Southern Seminary. Ken, I'd just like to open the conversation talking about your book, written in 1989, and a lot has changed since 1989. You mention in this book about the celebrity culture and right. What that does to American culture and to the world that we're seeking to evangelize, and you talk about People magazine and Us magazine and the whole gossip culture. Well, now you turn on MSNBC and or CNN, and it's Anna Nicole Smith all the time. Yeah. How have things changed since 1989?
Well, I think, as you suggested, it's simply an intensification. And the celebrity culture, actually, you begin to see it at the beginning of the 20th century with the rise, particularly, of motion pictures. Movies, the fact that they were early on called screen idols is no accident. Movies gave the capacity for the projection of a persona, a personality, quite apart from an actual person. Quite apart particularly from the character. A number of cultural historians have suggested that we begin to see a change in the late 19th, early 20th century, particularly with urbanization, begin to see a change in culture from a concern for the building of character for a concern with the projection of personality. There are all sorts of advice manuals that young people could buy in the late 19th century about how to build character. Things with either Christian or Stoic values. But beginning in the 1920s, as culture becomes more impersonal, as people in urban settings have more superficial relationships, have to meet more people, have to have relationships in a hurry, personality becomes the decisive factor. And you begin to see that in the teens and 20s. Movies come along as a mechanism to convey people who aren't necessarily great at acting, but they were great at acting out a persona. They're great at projecting a persona. And so, and I think I'll talk about this in my lecture tomorrow about image-based culture. Image in the literal sense, that is a picture of something, but also image in the figurative sense, the kind of things that public relations experts maintain. That becomes a profound concern. Image apart from any kind of reality is the concern. So in a sense, this is a long, long story. What has changed in the last 20 years or even in the last 40 years is that institutions that once served as mechanisms of restraint, keeping the lid on that dynamic, have decided if you can't beat them, join them. So serious journalists for most of the 20th century felt that that tabloid journalism, well, that was a dirty thing. It was a bad thing. You didn't pursue that. Mainstream media was not tabloid media. Another factor is mainstream media didn't make much money. The TV networks' news departments were always losing money until sometime in the 70s or 80s when they decided that they wanted to make money with their news operations. Instead of news being a public service, we can make money with news, but the only way we can make money with news is to go in the tabloid direction. So I think that what has happened, the biggest change, the dynamic was already there. What has happened is the institutions that were committing to restraining it or offering an alternative just kind of gave up. Mm-hmm. And one of my concerns throughout my adult life, or at least since I wrote All God's Children, is that the church historically has been one of those restraining institutions, mm-hmm. basically saying, you know, celebrityism, don't get caught up in it. Mm-hmm. It is a kind of idolatry. There's a reason why we call them American idols. Mm-hmm. And you ought not to get caught up in it. And yet, it's very tempting for Christian leaders in church and parachurch to mimic the mentality or the mechanisms of celebrity in order to gain a greater following. And then, once that happens, then the church, Christian institutions, are no longer operating as a kind of alternative gravitational pull, mm-hmm. if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, again, so I'd say the big thing that's happened is a lot of people have caved in the last 20 years.
So. Dr. Moeller and Dr. Coppinger, how do you see celebrity culture and pop culture emphases transforming Christian life in America?
I think the notion of being famous for being famous mm-hmm. has infected the entire culture. And one of the interesting things to note is that there were always persons of infamy and fame throughout history, but they generally were persons who were already known for something else. It may be social status. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lady Godiva was a titled member of the nobility. Mm-hmm. You have now the fact that you can have Anna Nicole Smith or something that's just come out of nowhere. So in one case, it's kind of the democratization of the ability to become infamous.
Right.
And to create an image and to sell it. I really appreciate what Ken had to say. You have the migrating up of bad practices. As a matter of fact, the three networks used to have to justify their access to the public airwaves
right.
on the basis of the fact that they were doing this public service of journalism. And the first of the bad practices to migrate up was the if it bleeds, it leads kind of format. Mm-hmm. So you all of a sudden had a refocusing of the news on the spectacle because it made for good visuals. And now, of course, you have the celebrity stuff and all the rest. And what happens is that the news departments have to, this is a commercial product. They have to justify their bottom line. They saw the success of the more Entertainment Tonight kind of thing. And so now it's migrated up. And so you have the sad, sad spectacle of seeing persons who actually have at least in the past done serious journalism, mm-hmm. trying to treat this as if it is serious. Mm-hmm. You ask how this affects Christianity and the church, it's exactly the same way. These bad practices are going to bubble up. Instead of the church saying, we ought not to do this, we ought not to fall into this pattern, you see churches that do the very same thing. We have our own Christian celebrities. Especially when you look at the younger culture, youth culture. But for that matter, I was stunned when I was in one of our trade bookstores the other day, and Joyce Meyer, dare I say the name, has a magazine now modeled after
That's
Oprah's
right.
magazine.
That's right.
And guess who's on the front cover?
She is.
And she will always be.
She will always be.
It's why it has her name on the magazine. And every article, the thing that differentiates this from Oprah's magazine is that apparently all the content is written by her because no one else has any credit whatsoever for having anything to do with this magazine. But we have Joyce Meyer on diet, on physical fitness, on recovering from divorce, and on financial advice and all the rest. You know, we too have this being famous for being famous phenomenon. You know, why in the world should we care about what anyone thinks about any of these issues, mm-hmm. Who supposedly is just famous, you know, for being famous. Daniel Boorstin talked a great deal about the image and the pseudo-event in history. And this is another thing that I think happens with Christians and with churches. We fall into this idea that we, too, have to have pseudo-events mm-hmm. In order to make sure people know we are here. And we've gotten more sophisticated at this because when I was a teenager, it used to be the Independent Baptist Church down the street that had Goldfish Day. So if you brought a friend, mm-hmm. you got a goldfish. Well, that was a spectacle all into its own. But now it's just a whole lot more sophisticated. And now we can do everything. We can do the television stuff. We can do the media stuff. We can do the celebrity. I mean, the coverage of the BBC of Ted Haggard's church in that sad spectacle focused first on the smoke machines and the lights
right.
With the music that began what was called as worship. And here you had a BBC reporter who had no obvious Christian concerns demonstrated at any point during the report, nonetheless had aesthetic concerns, to say, I had never seen anything like this called worship before. They even had an equivalent of an adolescent mosh pit at the front of this worship area. You know, we have lost something priceless when that is what is reported about us.
You know, I don't think there's any way to prevent celebrity of some sort, that if society was just all level all the time, that no one rose, that would be a very odd sort of circumstance, sort of like everyone in quilted jackets holding a Mao book or something. That would be sort of drab. So people surface. And I mean, I thank God he surfaces on Larry King. I mean, there is a certain celebrity to our president. But it does seem the case. I didn't live back then, but it did seem that celebrity was tied to achievement in a way. The Babe Ruth, even though he had a checkered life morally, hit a lot of home runs. Charles Lindbergh flew over the Atlantic, and Billy Graham in his day, you know, with her saying Puff Graham there, but he was preaching the gospel. But today, celebrity for celebrity's sake, like, I still don't get Paris Hilton. I mean, what is that? It's just famous for being famous. And so it's just cheapened. Our celebrity is so cheapened. That's a depressing sort of thing. I think one way it gets into the church, unfortunately, is that to maintain celebrity, to achieve it and to maintain it, sometimes you have to have a shtick. You know, that's your thing. He's the guy who, you know, scratches his forehead and barks or something, so we'll put him on. And it seems to me that, you know, treating the gospel or treating the word of God with any integrity has some complexity to it. I mean, sometimes Jesus would say to the Hillel people on divorce, tighten up. And I think he would say to the Pharisees over picking grain on Sabbath, lighten up. And your shtick might be the tough guy shtick or the sweetie guy shtick. So you do the Spang shtick, you do the Sharpton shtick, and pretty soon you're captive to your celebrity. And you have to deliver. And I think that it can undermine the integrity and the thoughtfulness of a Christian leader if he just has to deliver his celebrity shtick.
Yeah, if I could just add a personal experience from that, one of my most interesting engagements in the media was the Donahue Show a while back, and I was on with a panel, and the most active protagonist was Shmuley Boteach, the rabbi whom I had confronted several times, and I was really thrown off balance off the air by what would go on. It would be the full court press. You are an enemy of the people. You are committing spiritual genocide. As soon as the break, so how are the kids? And funny thing is, you go, how can you do this? You know, if this is as important as you say it is, you know what? They're fine, thank you. But what do you do with this? I just don't quite get it.
The shtick point, I think, is interesting.
Yeah, if I could pick up on that, because I think that I read an interesting essay recently by Neil Gabler, who has written histories about movies, and wrote a book called Life the Movie, which is on how we now try to make our lives cinematic. It used to be that art imitated life, now life imitates art. So we try to have lives that are worthy of being filmed. But he argues that he wants to take Daniel Boorstin's famous for being famous and saying, well, there is a kind of achievement. It's not home runs. It's not caring for the sick and dying. It's the achievement of celebrity itself. So celebrity becomes an art form, he argues. And so you see, it's fascinating to read articles about Britney Spears. Well, it's not that fascinating, but to see in the last 2 weeks, can she save her career? The issue is not... For instance, in Entertainment Weekly, there's no sense at all that this is a woman who has some serious issues in her life, and whose fall didn't begin when she shaved her head, but whose fall began when she began prancing in a Catholic naughty schoolgirl costume. That's when her life began to fall apart. For these editors and these writers, it's all about, will she successfully achieve the making of this career, and so the making of the career is tied up with the sustaining of the persona, so it's all about acting, and I think the reason that's important is I think there are aspects of modern and postmodern culture in which many people at some deep level feel that they are acting their lives. They may not have shtick that's as famous as some of the celebrities on television, but a lot of people feel that they don't live a life. They act out. I said yesterday in one of my talks that we used to have lives, now we have lifestyles. And so this whole question, you use the word integrity. Integrity used to mean consistency with a core of character. But if character is something that's kind of implausible because of a deeper kind of relativism, then all there is acting out, in a sense.
You know, there are a couple of flashpoints to kind of get our attention, and right now the bad girls in the society are one of them. Newsweek magazine ran a cover story about 3 weeks ago with the pictures of three of these let's just call them females with issues, following tradition here. And
FWI.
That's right. And it was bad girls gone wild. Right. Now, what's interesting is the letters in the next issue castigating Newsweek and cutting right through the quick, saying, don't act like you were doing serious journalism. This was finally Newsweek's opportunity to put these three faces on the front of the magazine. I thought the readers really indicted Newsweek on that, and some pretty devastating letters. Then the other thing is New York Magazine, which I find to be one of the most interesting pictures into the culture, on the fact that the generation now, the Generation Y, the millennials, whatever you want to call them, the 19 to 30-year-olds, are really able to have technologies of social construction and of identity construction that didn't exist previously.
Right.
And this particular article lists four different things that now are axioms of this generation. And one of them is, I'm documenting my adolescence, and that's the Facebook kind of phenomenon.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, I am my own celebrity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so now with the internet, websites, and all the rest, we can know what a 16-year-old had for breakfast, you know, which color Cheerios or Fruit Loops is his favorite,
and what he wished he had had, and what he'll have tomorrow.
Right, but you also have this. What you're talking about now, it's like I have to be this person to show up.
Right.
In
well,
this
and,
persona.
And that bleeds over into some other interesting phenomena that the technologies make possible. Facebook is everybody becomes a celebrity because everybody becomes their own press agent.
Mm-hmm.
So people who don't have the money or the necessity of hiring an image manager, they become their own image manager. Well, it's kind of fun. It's kind of like playing dress up, but it has a kind of pathology associated with if you play dress up too long or if you dress up inappropriately. So it is a kind of almost multiple personality disorder that kind of enters in, where the persona that you're playing, you basically figure out how to invent a persona, and the persona, in a sense, the building of character is also the emulation of a persona. You know, we're to imitate Christ, and yet that's the emulation, first of all, of a virtuous persona, but secondly, it's not for the sake of its shtick value. It's not for the sake of its immediate titillation and showing how fun you are. It'd be interesting to look at Facebook and see how many people try to project a presence or a personality which conforms, say, to the fruit of the Spirit, or the four cardinal virtues.
Well, that gets right to an experience I had last week. A youth minister in one of our larger churches told me of a 14-year-old girl in his church who had a Facebook page entitled "Promiscuous Girl," and the parents found out about this. The youth ministry found out about this. And the person they encountered in this online identity was completely disconnected from the person they thought they knew.
Right.
So you can even create a persona. I mean, who knows what the real Britney Spears is like?
Right.
It's going to be troubled, whatever you come up with.
Right.
But who actually knows?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are we looking at here?
Yeah, a lot of the online role-playing games kind of use this. And there are now a whole new species of counseling for people who suffer from a kind of self-induced personality disorder because they spend hours and hours. I years ago read an article about a man who was addicted to one of these online role-playing games and played the role of a woman. He had an alternate persona mm-hmm. as a woman, and actually fell in love with someone who at least was playing the role of a man, and had this online affair in the guise of a woman. This is a married man with like two or three kids, and it basically ruined his marriage for obvious reasons.
I think we're redefining the word issues.
Yeah, yeah. I want to throw something into this, again, to show that this is not an entirely new thing. I was just rereading some excerpts from Daniel Bell's Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, the first part of which is a wonderful tour de force on modernity and its effect, particularly on 20th century culture. And he talked about how early in the 20th century, fun morality displaced goodness morality. Goodness morality was about interfering with impulses. Not having fun becomes an occasion for self-examination. What's wrong with me? I'm not having fun. And he argues that's a new thing in human experience. Again, it's tied up. I just did a long feature on the work of Philip Reif, sociologist who was a brilliant analyst of Freud and the influence that Freud had on contemporary culture. You never thought we'd got into something so deep going from Augustine.
That's right.
We're getting into Freud now. And one of the points Reif makes is that Freud's prescription was for the loss of a confidence in objective reality and objective goodness is that desires, personal desires, become an anchoring point, if mm-hmm. you will. So that whatever your desires are, that's the authentic part of your life. Rather than seeing that desires are something that need to be trained and that need often to be repudiated, desires become a kind of the natural law, as it were. And so mm-hmm. it makes sense, if that's the case, that are we having fun yet becomes the ultimate moral question.
Daniel Yankelevich, there was a book called New Rules that he wrote a number of years ago, and mm-hmm. he talked about a psychiatrist receiving this young woman. She was just all frazzled and defeated and depressed and probably sick, and he said, well, tell me about your life, what you've been into. And she said, well, you know, I go bar hopping at night and, you know, go to happy hour and then stay out all night and then go home with, a stranger and, you know, have anonymous sex and get up early and go back to work and get very little sleep and eat badly and stuff like this. And he said, well, why don't you stop doing that? And she said, you mean I don't have to do what I feel like doing? She thought there was a moral law
that she had
to act according to the immediate
right.
impulse
right. Mm-hmm.
and that somehow she was practicing bad faith or being lacking integrity.
If she had
any
discipline, authentic. If
she'd be more authentic. Right. So she just was, her whole life was spontaneous
right.
and she was wrecking herself. And she thought it was a moral duty.
Yeah. If I can add just a caption to our discussion here, what I think we've hit on is that popular culture isn't just some trivial, frivolous thing that's out there, but that popular culture often reflects some of the deepest trends in contemporary culture.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you, is do you think that there even is such a thing as popular culture now? Because, I mean, you think about, there was that famous photograph of Richard Nixon with Elvis Presley in the 1970s. It was so remarkable because it was the collision of worlds. Now, Al Gore is standing next to Leonardo DiCaprio receiving an Academy Award. Well, no one thinks anything of it.
Right. And another way of asking it, is there anything, could we identify any high culture now or serious culture?
Right.
That becomes a rather porous boundary. Beginning in the 60s also, not just with the ascent of popular culture into traditional domains of seriousness, but with the rise of pop art, for instance. Mm-hmm. Pop art is a movement that is very deliberately saying, let's take the dynamics of fashion and frivolity and bring them into the art gallery and bring them into what used to be a kind of haven for some sense of gravity. And so in a sense, things have been merging for some time. So I think part of that is because of the fact that as a culture more broadly, we are not prepared to identify hierarchies of value. That was Richard Weaver's main point in Ideas Have Consequences. We cannot posit an order of values, an order of goods is the word he used. He would never use the word values. That's too Nietzschean for him. Mm-hmm. So the idea of us actually saying that some things are better than other things and that some things are ultimately good and some things are evil is When that disappears, then social institutions that historically have served to kind of convey, you know, there's nothing wrong with being with having fun, but we don't regard having fun as important as doing justice, for instance. Mm-hmm.
I think the picture is actually worse than we might imagine. In a lot of ways, you're bringing in of Daniel Bell. Is tremendous here. We have to bring in economics.
That's right. Yeah.
Into the picture, because the Victorian era was the era of the middle brow, and what happened is that you had persons who, with new economic means, wanted to look like, and Britain was the place where this first emerged, they wanted to look like their betters, which was the phrase that was used. And in a very classified, stratified society, you had the nobility and the gentry, and then you had everybody else until there was this middle class. And the middle class wanted different taste, and so the neo-Gothic revival was a middle class revival in Victorian England. The rise of the book as a commodity sold in bookstores, and the idea that there ought to be a library of fine books that would be in every home, very Victorian. And of course, it spread over to the United States. The Book of the Month Club became a phenomenon of that. The Chautauqua kind of circuit became very much a part of that. But there was something about the elite culture that was understood to be a centering, securing, hierarchical good that would anchor. A popular taste, all the way back to Caesar with bread and circuses could be tolerated so long as there was an anchor at the very top of the civilization. And thus you have in the more Victorian era, you've got Matthew Arnold talking about culture and what's the alternative to culture? Anarchy. And then in the 20th century, you have T.S. Eliot with his understanding, again, of the necessity of an elite. Well, here's the bad news. There still is such an elite. There still is an art community. There still is a literary community, which would touch no more than 2 to 3% of the American population. These are the people that... someone like Roger Kimball really studies very well, editor of the New Criterion. This is the world of high art, of high literature, and of high music. The bad news is that that world is now completely decoupled from any sense of accountability to secure the culture, morally and culturally. And instead, if anything, it is more Nietzschean than pop culture. Mm-hmm. And so now you have the people at the very top looking down at the bourgeois concerns of the middle and mm-hmm. of pop culture. We have an inversion. I mean, actually, the further up you go, the worse it is. Kimball's latest book, you know, demonstrates that it is almost a pure embrace of Nietzsche and nihilism, mm-hmm. you know, at the very top. The most expensive art, other than the titled art, if you look at the New York art scene, If you've got a Picasso or a Renoir or anything like that, you're talking about people that just want to buy status. But other than that, the art that is selling is art that, as Kimball says, means nothing. Mm-hmm. And it's embraced precisely for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, in art museums all over the country that are exhibiting right now human corpses in the Body Worlds exhibit.
Yeah. Well, and there are other elites. I wrote an essay years ago for Modern Reformation called Is Popular Culture Either? And which I argued that if culture is really a transmission of convictions from one generation to another, then popular culture doesn't do that, strictly speaking. But secondly, it's not really popular.
Well,
there are elites. So there are elites in the pop culture world also who still have that kind of status. And now let me offer a glimmer of hope through the clouds here for a minute. There are a lot of exceptions.
Absolutely.
There are exceptions to this, and I'm always a lot of my work involves finding secular prophets. You know, mm-hmm. in Titus, in the letter to Titus, Paul quotes Epimenides, who was a Cretan philosopher, and he says one of their own prophets has said, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All Cretans are liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. And this testimony is true, he says. Paul provides a great model for cultural discernment by looking for the secular prophet, finding someone from within that setting who who perceives, who sees the problem, and may, as I suggested in one of my talks yesterday, may see it more deeply than we do because they don't have anything else. They don't have any transcendent possibilities, so culture is all they have. And there are a lot of people like that. And
you think of hip-hop music, for instance, on fatherlessness and father hunger.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the most bracing pictures of this you can find.
So there are a lot of glimpses of that a sense of the disorder. Part of my longing is that it would be possible to see for people who see that disorder to look at the church as a community that's not caught up in the same disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why I've been for a long time upset about, nervous about the emulation of disorder as a marketing tool for the church, as it were,
mm-hmm.
rather than the church being a kind of haven of integrity, and a haven of recognizing a full humanity, so that people who I had friends at NPR who looked at let's say market-driven churches, let's call them that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one friend once who actually produced a report for All Things Considered that Linda Wertheimer hosted of a big mega church that, and she said to me, she said, "What do you think of this church?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" She said, "Well, I'm not a religious person, but if I was ever interested in spirituality, that's the last place I'd go."
Mm-hmm.
She said, "There's nothing transcendent there."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how interesting that that was her sense. So I think that, the church always needs to ask, how can we make a point of contact with people who are disenchanted with the world, not how can we make a point of contact with people who are really in love with the world.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I think that often you see this not just in those churches that are intentionally trying to emulate the culture.
Yeah, yeah.
You think of, for instance, I noticed sometime around in the 80s that people singing solos in church worship events would take the microphone and look longingly into one another's eyes.
Right.
No one told them to do that.
Right.
They were mimicking what they had seen on
exactly.
the screen.
Exactly.
And don't count on no one telling them to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, at least in the venues I'm talking about right now.
I may have done that.
Yeah,
sure.
Sure. I can guarantee you I never have.
I'll tell you about my checkered past. I will say that when I was 16 or 17, my goal in life was to sing with Thurlow Spurr and the Spurlows, if that means anything.
Can I pitch in just a quick question about high and low? Yesterday you were talking, I think you were quoting C.S. Lewis, saying there's a distinction between moving man to conform to reality or trying to spin reality so it fits man.
Right.
And so truth comes into play here. I was reading the other day about Verdi's opera, Aida, and it was written for the Pasha or whatever of Egypt. And it turns out it's false in that this guy's torn between, will I go with the Ethiopian slave girl or will I go with the Pharaoh's daughter? And and the truth of the matter is he could have had them both in Egypt.
Yeah.
And some say Verdi was preaching to them a little bit like only one. But still, it was not a true picture. But when I listen to the Eagles, "Get Over It," I will read just a bit here about your whines and say, "You drag it around like a ball and chain. You wallow in the guilt. You wallow in the pain. You wave it like a flag. You wear it like a crown. Got your mind in the gutter, bringing everybody down. Complain about the present. Blame it on the past. I'd like to find your inner child." And it goes on. And it's like he's got it right. Rebuke that. That's popular culture.
Right.
That's a rock band.
Right.
And he's got it truer than Verdi.
Right.
What's the touchstone? What makes Verdi higher than the Eagles singing? I know it's simpler.
Right.
I know scoring an opera is more difficult than writing.
Well, I mean,
this,
I'd say, before you got to your question, I was thinking, to what extent here we get into questions of form. To what extent is the form resonant with the message? To what extent does the form sustain the kind of inner conviction that the message has? And one of the things that characterizes the form of a lot of pop culture, and I get a little bit in the chapter on rock and roll in the book, that a lot of the forms of popular culture have a kind of restlessness about them. And I think they do this largely for economic reasons. Yeah. No one wants to create a single that you listen to and then turn off and quietly meditate for the next hour. You want music that's going to leave you wanting more. And then you want the next one. And then you want the next one. And then you want... And it also creates a restlessness that makes you want to buy things. It makes you into a pliable consumer. So there is a kind of... I'd say there's a kind of restlessness. Now, there's restlessness in what we call... in some forms of high culture also. But one of the things that characterizes particularly... the Western musical tradition up until, let's say, Wagner, is a kind of ideal of resolution and an ideal of a kind of fulfillment, and so it does have a kind of end in view. And so, I guess, I'd say that there are all sorts of wonderful messages and there are all sorts of wonderful insights that can be sustained, and that song is much more insightful than any number of high culture songs that might be sung, but I think that again the question of the suitability of the form, but also the question of the kind of telos, the kind of end,
But I think there's something else here on the survivability of cultural artifacts. I mean, for instance, you just cited Verdi. Good number of people in this room would know who you're talking about, but wouldn't know that Verdi was a controversial figure within the operatic world himself, and that, for instance, Verdi's form of the opera was rather controversial, but partly because he stayed with the older operatic form. And I mean, he had others like Puccini that were much lighter fare, you know, bringing stories in and music in, much lighter fare. And the fact is, Verdi still sung. You know, and it is still a part of the cultural apparatus of a certain part of the society. I mean, Verdi's Requiem I played two nights ago as I was reading. I didn't play the Eagles, and I don't think anyone 100 years from now has been playing the Eagles. I do think 100 years from now they're still going to be, and if nothing else, 100 years from now, commercials are still going to have Verdi in the background. Because there's just something about the structure. But all that to say, I think at the level of elite culture, one of the things that at least was the ambition of the past was to write, to produce, to compose something that would last.
I
think there still is that ambition among the elites.
Yeah.
I want to do something that will last.
In fact, I mentioned pop art a few minutes ago. There was a manifesto for pop art that was created. I think his name was Lawrence Hamilton in the 1950s. And he said the whole point of our movement is to make just things that are disposable. I mean, there was a very deliberate effort to repudiate this striving for eternity and transcendence that had marked the world of high culture. Now, part of that was because it was so agonizing. A number of critics have said that pop art arises because the big movement in art that preceded it, abstract expressionism, just required so much discipline and hard work and self-denial and asceticism. It was just so hard, and people just wanted to have fun for a change. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing, interesting difference is, you mentioned Verdi, who's a composer whose works are still performed, and the Eagles, who are a set of performers. Now, they wrote their songs, too. But one of the things that pop culture, as we now experience it, which actually has changed in the 20th century, pop culture used to be Cole Porter, George Gershwin. It was the music rather than the performances. And ever since, I don't know, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album, the performance, often studio-enhanced, actually, it's the performance of the guys in the booth as much as it is the musicians. You don't have to be Milli Vanilli to know that. So that becomes the artifact. The artifact becomes the performance with all of the accoutrements associated with it rather than the composition.
I've really been struggling with something about music in this respect. My favorite postmodern classical composers is Arvo Pärt, who's a Lithuanian composer, and another one that really fascinates me with his music is Henry Górecki, especially with his Third Symphony. And with Pärt and his great piece, Lamentate, and with Gorecki with his Symphony of Sorrows, Third Symphony. If you've never heard those, just go buy them and get 2 hours and just turn them on and see
and
where your thoughts
lead you.
And
remain silent for the 2 hours.
Yes, you're going to have to remain silent. But both of those are telling huge stories.
Yeah.
The Gorecki Third Symphony is talking about the rape of Poland by the Nazis and then by the Soviets. And Lamentate about the absolute crushing of national identity and of personal identity and the rupturing of families. The Holocaust is not something the Eagles can put to music.
Right, yeah.
And I think that is one thing that's really missing in this culture is there are some stories that are so big,
right.
You can't possibly reduce them to what pop culture
yeah.
does. And I think what I'm talking about here is an article I'm working on right now simply because I fear what we're doing in the church is forgetting that we have a story that's so big,
right.
It can't be reduced to some of these things we try to call worship songs.
But you've got the Negro Spiritual, you've got Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, mm-hmm. Deep River. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'm going over, Jordan. And that's
sure.
pretty simple,
yeah.
but it can
oh,
be
yeah.
profound.
Yeah.
It doesn't
oh,
have to
yeah.
be a symphony.
Well,
I mean, I understand.
No, I'm not suggesting it has to be a symphony, but it has to be.
It's simple.
It has to be serious.
Right,
right.
And it has to be memorable.
Yeah.
It has to be singable. And it has to be true in some great sense.
Yeah.
It has to tie.
Well,
you.
And that's not only true in the realm of music. I'm very concerned about, for instance, the VeggieTales phenomenon, taking biblical narrative
careful
and turn.
Oh,
okay. Okay. I said.
I gave the brush to the peach because he had hair.
Okay. I said it to one group of people who were asking me about VeggieTales. I would almost rather my children see an episode of Desperate Housewives than an episode of VeggieTales because it would be easier to deconstruct
yeah, yeah.
the one than the other.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that there are, especially with young children, the way that we yeah. take visual
yeah.
media and transform the narrative.
Well, transform the narrative or insist that everything can be fun. I mean, that,
right.
in fact, there was a secular critic, again, who years ago wrote an essay on Sesame Street and its influence on
mm-hmm.
culture, in which he basically said that what Sesame Street wasn't taught most wasn't the alphabet or counting, but it taught that education had to be fun,
right.
that all learning had to be fun. And so that would be my concern, not just the possibility of trivialization, but the possibility of the assumption that everything will be
trivialization, not just of the content itself,
right.
but of things that cannot be there. You cannot have crucifixion
right.
in a
right.
cartoon.
Yeah, well, you mm. could
not in a way that would be appropriate.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons you can't have a Jesus vegetable either.
Right.
You
that's
know,
right.
That
right.
That's one of the limitations
is
of that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to pick up on your Arvo Pärt example.
I'm trying to imagine some generation listening to this wondering what in the world we got to with that.
Don't go there.
Is this discussion for the ages?
You know, one of the things I've found intriguing in the nomenclature that's used to describe the appropriation of popular forms in the church is contemporary worship.
Right.
And the reason I balk at that because of the fact that the 20th century is one of the deadliest centuries in human history, one of the most tragic centuries in human history.
The most deadly.
Yeah, yeah. The writer who probably captures the 20th century best is somebody like Alexander Solzhenitsyn. And the examples you mentioned of Pärt and Gorecki, they're very much, that's contemporary Christian music.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the idea that contemporary Christian music is only of a particular form, I find it shows a lack of appreciation for what the contemporary really is. What is the nature of our times? So if we step back and say, what is the nature of our times? What kinds of music are appropriate to the nature of our times, not just the nature of show business or the nature of entertainment in the world. And that's where I think that that the church has to be honest about the age that we're living in.
Mm-hmm.
And if the church only sees the glitzy side of the age that we're living in and say that's what we have resonance with, rather than recognize the tragedies of the age that we're living
in
also.
That's a very appropriate point. I heard from a woman one time who had just lost her husband. And she said, I'm not going to church this Sunday because I can't deal with the hilarity of it all.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, how shocking when you have psalms of lament and transcendence, and that's missing in her church.
I think it was Jean Veith who said there are tens of thousands of older people in nursing homes today who don't have a pastor they trust to do their funerals.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Because the pastor has been so eager to look like Seinfeld for the last 10 years that they're not confident
and
he'll do their funeral.
And this creeps in the most amazing way. I'm going to make a cultural admission here. I got all the way through adolescence and college without ever seeing Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And I actually saw it only about 2 years ago. And an entire world made sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay. All of a sudden, I realized all this stuff I had been hearing, it all of a sudden made sense. I now saw where it came from. Yeah. And I realized, this one film is just this engine for this enormous stuff. Then you mentioned VeggieTales, and you have Joshua, veggies, marching around the thing, and there are the French peas at the top of the thing, giving their taunts.
Right. Yeah.
You know, where does this come from? All of a sudden, you realize this is just the worst form of the emulation of this, and at the same time, I don't want to thunder like Elijah here because I laughed. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, I laughed, and I would, if I saw it again, I'd laugh again. But the thing is, you know, at least we realize, you know, that let's see that for what it is.
Yeah,
let's see Monty Python for what it is.
Yeah,
you know, Nacho Libre for what it is.
Right,
you know,
just
name it for what it is.
Right.
And I'm not embarrassed to say I laughed.
Right.
You know, it was therapeutic. But let's not take any great
And let's retain
meaning out
let's
of this.
And let's retain multiple registers.
Yeah,
I mean,
let's admit it.
That's one of the other dilemmas of our cultural moment is that it's increasingly the case if you turn on television that there's only a single register. There's only a single tone of voice. Increasingly, whereas everyone is kind of working towards a kind of single sensibility. And there are multiple sensibilities. There's nothing wrong with fun. There's nothing wrong with levity. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with satire. But when that becomes the only voice and the only possible register, and particularly when that becomes when there becomes a very limited register in worship, and I think that's something that particularly.
Let's talk about pastors specifically in training people to be discerning. I think that you and I talked yesterday a little bit about your growing up in a home in which you were not allowed to go to movies, and then you went on to study film studies.
Yeah.
But there was something about that. There was something about
my grandmother. Never knew that.
That's right. There's something about what your grandmother was concerned about that we both acknowledge was appropriate in a way that it's very hard for us to see now. And one of the things I'm most concerned about are Christians who believe that discernment when it comes to popular culture means counting cuss words and naked ladies, as opposed to seeing some of the much more subtle and discerning. I happen to the other day come home from being somewhere all night and being up all night, and I had the children by myself, and I did something I never do, which is to sit them in front of the television and turn on PBS Kids while I zoned out on the couch. And I noticed that through all of these programs that went on for over an hour, there was a recurring theme. You are special. You're the only you there is, and that makes you a star. And I realized I recognize this for what it is. It's a catechism.
Right.
But it's nothing that's unclean. It's nothing that's inappropriate.
Right.
But our people, I wonder how often they don't notice those things.
Right.
Or advertising, the way that advertising shapes us.
Right.
How should pastors seek to train people to notice what you noticed in your commentary this morning about, for instance, songs that no longer see marriage as a goal? How do you train people to think that
way? Marriage completely absent from popular music, whereas it's not even really even dismissed anymore.
It's
not the old, ball and chain anymore.
Right.
It's now just gone.
See, but you should listen to country music because we do still have divorce.
Yeah.
At least there was a marriage.
DIVORC is what we get.
Yeah, I just want you to know you missed my message on adultery. Because you were busy taking care of your dear wife and new son. But I did mention the fact that in country music you do have now the wallowing in adultery. So I will give you that.
But the pain that comes along after it, too.
Yeah.
So there's,
yes,
there's that.
Right.
There's that element.
We'll commodify that, too.
And you can dance to it.
Yeah, you can dance to it.
The first thing that I would say about pastors is, number one, let's be aware that we are deeply embedded in a culture. Let's begin with a bit of self-analysis and knowing our own placement and trying to deconstruct a bit our own enmeshness in the midst of all of this. What perplexes me are a lot of evangelical pastors who say, "I just don't worry about the culture."
Yeah,
you know, which is ridiculous.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're
working
just
through Romans again, or something.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
As if they're not.
Well, and as if they're not getting dressed every
right.
morning and deciding,
exactly.
you know, how they're going to look and what they're going to say and you know what they're going to talk with their friends about. That's all. They just mean the worst part of pop culture they don't want anything to do with,
right.
or the most trendy culture they don't want to have anything to do with. But we're all deeply embedded in a cultural system, and this is where actually a lot of the postmodern analysis can help us.
Yeah.
And just
oh,
look
yeah.
at that. You know, here yeah. we are. We're deeply, our cultural linguistic system is, you know, very much at play here. We are in Wittgensteinian language games. We are trading concepts like loose change. Let's look at all of this, and then let's remember that our people are also deeply enmeshed in these things in ways they don't understand. And you know, mm-hmm. when people hear me speak, they know I'm always going to mention Aristotle's fish. You know, he doesn't know he's wet.
Right.
And that's Aristotle recognizes one of the greatest philosophical problems. You can't get yourself out of yourself in order adequately to observe yourself, to be self-critical and know exactly where you are. Like Aristotle's fish, we're swimming and we're wet. But let's try to do our best to figure that out. I think the Apostle Paul gives us, again, some very good models for that. I think he understands who he is. I think he understands who his people group is that he's trying to reach. I think he understands Athens for what Athens is like. And yet, we're just too much at love with the world. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Well, I think that's... I'm glad you ended that way. A nice segue, because I've been thinking about worldliness as a category that has kind of disappeared.
That's right.
I gave a talk several years ago on Francis Schaeffer's legacy, and I called it the Bohemian Temptation, because I argued that what Schaeffer did was to liberate a whole generation of Christians from a false definition of worldliness. Mm-hmm. You know, when he was giving lectures right. on Fellini's films,
right.
the students at Wheaton College weren't allowed to see Bambi.
Mm-hmm.
And here he is, mm-hmm. you know, giving lectures
about
Fellini and
Bergman. Which was written by a child pornographer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the other part of the culture. And we think some things are safe, and
right.
actually Bambi
right.
is not a
yeah.
safe story,
yeah.
and Salatin was a pornographer.
But... But what Schaeffer did was liberate from a
false
idea, a false idea of worldliness. But many of his heirs have not succeeded in saying, okay, if that's not worldliness, then what is?
Right.
And that gets at what you said. We're not just going to count the profanities and the blasphemies or count
the TV
sexual references.
That
right,
out.
Right. That there's actually a deeper kind of disorder that needs to be recognized.
You think of the damage done by an Amos and Andy, for instance,
earlier
in the 20th century.
Yeah.
I think it's something really deep missing from our conversation here that really plays into at least my analysis of pop culture. Two levels. First of all, we are the people who are supposed to believe we don't have satisfaction in this world. Not to say we do not have pleasures, mm-hmm. but we are not to seek to achieve total satisfaction in this world. You know, we have the ultimate principle of delayed gratification. We have an eschatological faith. And for that reason, we're the people who believe that you stay married, that you are faithful and raise your children, that you do without when necessary. All these run so counter to the culture. And I think we're forgetting that. And even as we imbibe all these cultural products and are immersed in this cultural system, we're buying into the fact that we really should seek to be satisfied. When we should be the people who understand we're never to be satisfied, not in this life. And if we find some satisfaction in this life, we'll know it's a false satisfaction. The second thing is, we're the people, in terms of just delayed gratification and all the rest, who are supposed to know that there are certain ways certain things are supposed to happen, like sex and marriage, like babies and all the rest. I was reading a brilliant work just recently on Shakespeare's love sonnets, which actually were as popular as his dramas, his plays, during his own lifetime and in the Elizabethan era. But the main theme of Shakespeare's love sonnets is not consummated love. It's the anticipation of mm-hmm. consummated love. It is sexual longing. And this particular writer said, this is what is missing. It's now nearly impossible. adolescents no longer experience sexual longing
mm-hmm.
In the way they did in Elizabethan England, and mm-hmm. thus the poetry doesn't make any sense.
Right.
You don't need Shakespeare if you're having sex with your girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You only need Shakespeare if you're not. And you look forward to that day when you once will have her as wife and enjoy such pleasures. And I thought that, and that's just profound. You know, no wonder our own teenagers are seduced by this culture because we don't even recognize what's happening.
Wilfred McClay, a mutual friend of ours, mentioned one time teaching the Scarlet Letter and that his students could not make sense of it.
Right.
And it's not because they could not understand Hawthorne. It's that they couldn't understand guilt.
Right.
Why on earth would you feel this guilty? Why would you have this weight upon you? And he realized he had to just do an entire course to get them ready for the Scarlet Letter.
Last week, I mentioned the Scarlet Letter because it's obviously a book and you can contrast. But the interesting thing is that that book was not written in the period of which it depicts.
Right.
It was written
mm-hmm.
in 1850. Right. And Nathaniel Hawthorne wrote it as an indictment not of shame and guilt, but of hypocrisy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we've almost reached the point in which certain forms of hypocrisy are impossible in this culture.
Right, right. Yeah, I think Richard Neuhaus said years ago, what we need are a lot more good hypocrites mm-hmm. in the culture. That
mm-hmm.
We would sustain, they
That's
would
right.
they would be trying to present a concern for virtue, even if they weren't themselves virtuous.
How do you criticize culture, and pop culture specifically, without becoming a culture scold?
Yeah.
I think, for instance, of a man who said recently, you don't criticize the culture as a preacher of the gospel, because to criticize the culture would be similar to criticizing the house that someone is living in. So you simply come in and present a positive message. I don't agree, specifically because that assumes that the problem is that the house is messy.
Right.
Whereas I think the problem is that the house is filled with carbon monoxide. And so you often have to come in and say, you need to get out of here in order to get in somewhere else.
Right.
But that is, his point is well made, that there is a difficult line to walk. How do you address culture without simply criticizing culture?
Well, I think you can only do it if there's a positive alternative that you're presenting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see that the church isn't just there to criticize something, but that the church is ideally a community that is living out a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're all kind of, I mean, raising two kids, you always want to give them something that's constructive and positive to enjoy. We exposed our kids to a lot of things, a lot of popular culture. I like to say that what we tried to do was to show them that things didn't have to be fashionable to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
So we exposed them to old movies and old music.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my daughter got really interested in Cole Porter's musicals. And they were reading and listening to and watching things that were really the best quality popular culture rather than the things that were happened to be popular.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was easier for them to navigate their way when they started making a lot of their own decisions, because they knew that they could select things that were really not just appealing but really had some kind of objective merit. So I think part of it is providing a significant alternative. But I do think that part of it is, again, also I think part of it is imparting a vision, especially if you're a pastor, that conversion is a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
That conversion isn't just adding a set of propositions about soteriology to your life, but it really it will challenge a lot of the assumptions and the cultural forms that have been the bearers of those assumptions
mm-hmm.
in your life. And so I think part of the biggest problem we face today is we don't have the church does not present a really hearty image of what conversion is. Go back to the early church. It's fascinating to see how serious conversion was taken. Often, if people were seekers, they would be seekers and catechumens for often a period of years before they would be baptized,
mm-hmm.
because the church leaders knew that people had to be converted away from something and not just converted to something,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't want to baptize someone who was a hypocrite, and so there were in fact in many churches in the up until the conversion of Constantine, when suddenly church growth wasn't a problem anymore, you would present yourself as a candidate for baptism, and one in many churches they would actually invite non-believing neighbors to come in, as long as there wasn't a threat of persecution. They'd invite non-believing neighbors to come in, and they'd ask the non-believing neighbors whether they had seen signs of a regenerate life in the neighbor. Can you imagine doing that today, inviting non-Christian neighbors in and saying, have you seen a changed life in Joe over the last couple of years? So I think a lot of it is conveying not a scold about, you know, don't watch this show or don't listen to this kind of music or anything, but conveying, first of all, that your whole life has got to be changed, and that means that the things that have been sustaining the infrastructure of your old life are open to question.
I think I have to add to that there are severe limits to the application of the principle you articulated.
Mm-hmm.
When you're citing, you know, you don't criticize another culture because it's a house someone's mm-hmm. living in. This is not a new issue for the Christian church. It wasn't a new issue for Israel.
Right.
Israel didn't say, you know, you go on sacrificing your babies to Molech, no big problem, that's the cultural house you're living in.
Mm-hmm.
The Apostle Paul in Athens didn't say, I see you have all these gods and you're very religious people, you just go on with a carnival. He said, we ought not to think that God desires mm-hmm. to live in a house made with human hands. You know, what we ought not to think is a pretty strong statement. There's very in your face, and that's what got him in trouble and basically led to his trial. In the Victorian era, with the great missionary expansion, when Christian missionaries got to India and found the practice of sati, the burning of widows on the funeral pyres of their husbands, they were faced with the very same thing that the postmodernists talk about right now. They were faced with arguments in England and among themselves that this is a practice that is simply a part of their Indian tradition. Therefore, we just have to accept it as being who they are. And the missionaries across the board, basically, in the Victorian era said, no, we can't do that because this is a violation of the Imago Dei. This is. There's no way that a people who give themselves to this will ever be able to understand the gospel as such as it is. So I think there are real limitations to how we could simply say you don't criticize another culture. I think you have to be missiological.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I appreciate what Ken had to say about, you know, pointing to something higher, but I also go back to the wonderful anecdote you told from Yankelovich. You know, at some point you simply have to say to someone, you got to stop doing some of that before you can even understand what I'm saying to
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're weirded out on drugs and all the rest and metaphorically on cultural artifacts, you know, you may have to get some real distance from that before you can hear what I'm talking about.
I think of an analogy. I mentioned Paul quoting Epimenides in Titus. That's a fascinating letter to me about cultural confrontation, because he starts, you know, there's all kinds of divisions in the church and false teachers, and this young pastor is having a real problem on his hands. Paul looks at the situation, sees it as emblematic of a kind of cultural captivity, and then he goes and says, teach those things which are fitting with sound doctrine or in accord with sound doctrine. And then rather than, it's the only letter I know where he has all this practical advice before he gets to the theology.
Mm-hmm.
He says, teach them to be self-controlled, teach the old men, all these responsibilities, which are almost like stoic virtues. It's not fruit of the Spirit. And it's all about self-control. In fact, if you tally up the list of virtues that he says you have to teach before you can teach them theology, before you can teach them what the gospel is, it's the exact opposite of being liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. So what I think he's doing is saying you need to inculcate a set of character qualities in the people to prepare them for hearing the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And take stock of the character qualities and the assumptions about reality that are the obstacles to obedience and faithfulness in the culture that you're in. And then figure out how you can kind of inculcate that before they're ready to even be receptive to hearing a message. People are not going to hear a message of repentance if they have been immersed in a culture of self-fulfillment. Mm. There are just so many dissonances that you have to work against.
And while we're criticizing another culture, we've got to be really honest that we're so deeply embedded in our own that we can no longer, we are the fish in the water. We
yeah.
can't see our own cultural inconsistencies, and we can't see where our culture is an impediment to the gospel. I mean, we can see some, but we can't see all. So we always have to be open to a critique from the outside.
Right. Right.
And we're not trying to sell a different culture. We're trying to convey the gospel, which is a transcultural, transtemporal reality.
Which is why the charge of hypocrisy from unbelievers is often helpful and often a gift of
show me where that is.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a proper running commentary you have on the culture as a pastor or a parent. I think of the old Milwaukee beer ad where guys are fishing and they're hauling in Alaskan king crab or fish down near Louisiana, and they open a can of beer and they say, you know, it doesn't get any better than this. And you stop with your kids and say, yeah. Is that true, Jedediah or Caleb, that it doesn't get any better than that? And you kind of say, for the lost, it probably tops out at fish and beer. But what is better? And then you say, but you remember when we were singing Christ Alone as a congregation and there was fullness to the singing and joy in the play? That was better than that, wasn't it? So you do. Mm-hmm. But you turn it on the church, too. Say, mm-hmm. What about what happened to church? That wasn't too great, was it? What was that about? Mm-hmm. And so I really think that running cultural commentary, and you kind of need to be up on the culture a bit to do it. I remember my pastor, when I was in grad school, happened to read Red Book in the waiting room of a barber shop or some, I don't know what it was, and he weighed in on Joan Rivers for her, you know, whatever. And he didn't even know that George Carlin and Lenny right. Bruce existed, you know, but this is the prophetic word against comedy today, and we thought, that's the only modern comedian you know, right?
Yeah.
And so a part of it is just having the creds to that you've read your stuff. I think that helps.
Well, that's an appropriate note on which to end. I'd like to challenge us to remember that it's been mentioned several times, the example of Paul at Acts 17. So often we have the confused idea that what Paul was doing is building a bridge, having all of the commonalities of the culture and then moving them to the point at which he could preach the gospel. It's actually the reverse of what the Apostle Paul is doing. He was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. That's the reason why he's hauled to Mars Hill. And there he says, you don't even believe what you say you believe. I'm listening to your own poets, to your own singers, and you're telling me there's something, that it does get better than this, in fact. Well, thank you all for being here today. Could you thank our panel for being present with us today?